Okay, Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 22 again says, "The blessing of Yahweh, it maketh rich, and it addeth no sorrow with it." Think again about that last part of that verse. Again, it says, "The blessing of Yahweh maketh rich." He wants us to be rich. It's obvious right there in that first half of that passage. But he also says, "He addeth no sorrow with it." When it's his blessing, when it's his riches, when it comes the way that he wants it to come, there is no sorrow with it. That can't be said about our economic system today. It is so far removed from what God's economic plan is found in his word that there's all kinds of sorrow with man's economic plans. With God's economic plans, it's nothing but blessings, and there's no sorrow with it. This will be Principles of Biblical Economics, Part 13. Thus far in this series, we've discussed the following seven principles of biblical economics. Number one, seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, work, that four-letter word. Number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable giving. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. And number seven, save, save, save. Some of those, of course, are not even would even be considered economic principles, but indeed, hopefully, you can see that things like Sabbathing and other things that we've already discussed indeed are a part of God's economic plan for our lives, if we'll only abide by it. All right, moving right along. Biblical economic principle number eight. And not to minimize any of the previous seven principles, but principle eight, as I'm sure and hopefully many of you already have figured out, principle number eight, as we get into it, is without question one of the more important biblical economic principles that we will discuss. And again, I do not mean to minimize. You can't minimize number one, seek him and his righteousness first. You can't minimize that. You can't minimize tithing and offerings and everything else that we've discussed. But I want to emphasize the fact that this is indeed one of those, especially in the day and age in which we live and under the economic system in which we find ourselves, this is indeed one of the more important that this generation of people and even Christians today need to desperately understand. Biblical economic principle number eight, do not become a slave. That is, do not, whatever you do, do not go into DEBT. That is, downright economic bondage on time. And I had to throw the O in there for on. But nonetheless, I think it's a pretty good acronym for the word debt. Do not, or downright economic bondage on time. That is, at least, don't go into debt voluntarily. In other words, I understand that emergencies sometimes can dictate that a person goes into debt. Emergencies sometimes can dictate. Sometimes it's beyond our ability because of an emergency, and we possibly don't have the means at the time that we must go into debt. But think about this, too. Too often we're too quick to run to the banker in an emergency rather than running to our God to begin with and asking him to relieve us of the situation. After all, he owns the cattle on a thousand hills, and that doesn't begin to describe his prosperity, the prosperity he has for his people. I mean, cattle on a thousand hills? I mean, how many hills are there and how many cattle are there on those hills? He owns them all. That and everything else on those hills. And so too often we're ready to run to the banker, another God, another Baal in the lives of so many people today, rather than running to our God and asking him to provide the means to get us out of the situation we find ourselves in. Again, that doesn't mean that sometimes under emergencies we may not find ourselves in that situation where we may have to go into debt. But otherwise, so long as it depends upon you, under normal circumstances, do not do it. Live within your means and make it your policy. And I even say make it a life commitment that if you can't afford it, you don't buy it. Plain and simple. Now, let's take our Bibles this morning and turn to Proverbs chapter 22. Proverbs chapter 22, and beginning with verse 7. or yes, beginning with verse 7, Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7, where we find the following, and we've already looked at this a few times previous to this message, but this is especially pertinent in discussion of this particular biblical economic principle. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 7, it says, "The rich ruleth over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender." New American Standard makes it even a little bit more pointed, and it says that the borrower is slave to the lender, which is really a better translation of the Hebrew word used in this particular instance. Now, before actually getting to the pertinent portion of this verse as it pertains to principle number 8, let's not overlook the first part of this very important proverb. The first part of this verse is what we might describe as the general principle or even the objective of this entire series. And I don't want to miss this. I want to emphasize this again. And that being simply dominion. Or I certainly shouldn't say simply. But that being dominion, that God has dominion in mind for His people, always have, always will. It's not when His people, by the way, do not have dominion. It's not His fault. That's been His plan. He's made it possible for us. It's not His fault when we don't have dominion. It's our fault. It's because we have somewhere along gone down a rabbit trail and rejected some of His principles somewhere in some fashion, whether it be economic principles or some other principle of His found in His Word on another matter. The fact is, as a general rule, according to Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7, the rich rule over the poor, speaking in generalities. That is the case. God is right there. It couldn't be stated any clearer. The rich rule over the poor. So, whoever, according to that general rule, according to that proverb, it's found in His Word, as God inspired Solomon to write it, therefore, whoever is the rich is going to have dominion. Again, I know that there's the big argument about who wrote the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And too often, I finally realize, we get sidetracked on the argument about who did it. I mean, not that it's not important to try to figure this out, but sometimes we get sidetracked on the argument, the debate about who wrote it. The fact is, somebody did, and they certainly weren't Christians, and in many cases they were anti-Christian, because so many of the protocols have to do with destroying Christianity. Somebody understood this principle. Somebody, I think, even read the Bible and knew what the Bible said in many regards. For example, in this regard, Protocol number 3, Article 5 in Sentence 1 says the following. It says, "All people are chained down to heavy toil by poverty more firmly than ever they were chained by slavery and serfdom." Sounds like the rich rule over the poor. And they wanted to take advantage of it, I guarantee, if you read the rest of the protocols. The fact is, Christianity has abrogated, has vacated the economic arena to the non-Christians and the anti-Christians. Oh, economics, that's not, except for maybe on just a personal level, but as Christianity as a whole, that's not spiritual. You know, again, so heavenly minded, they're of no earthly good, especially in this particular area. And again, we're speaking in generality. Some people do understand this, but it's not widespread throughout Christianity that this is understood, and they vacated this particular area. Consequently, non-Christians and Antichrist are ruling, are in power, and therefore, and even more importantly to understand from this perspective, is that they are determining legislation as a result, and therefore the moral direction of our nation. Interesting. Whoever it was who wrote the protocols seemed to understand this as well. Listen to Protocol 22, Articles 2 and 3 through sentences, Articles 2 and then 3 sentences 1 through 4. And Article 2 is only one sentence. It says, "In our hands," whoever it was, whatever Antichrist or non-Christians it was who was involved in the protocols, it said they claim that "in our hands is the greatest power of our day, gold." That might be indicative of maybe who wrote it, too. who has the gold today? They're claiming they've got it. You know, they've taken it out of our money, they've taken it out of our banks, and they're storing it somewhere else. Somebody else has for the most of it. You know, some of us may have a little bit here and there, but haven't our jewelry and so forth, but somebody has got the gold. And they said, in our hands is the greatest power of our day. Of course, that's not the greatest power of our day. They worship gold. It's like dancing around the golden calf. And they think that is the greatest power. There is a greater power. But the point being, they understand there's power in gold, in money, real money. And it says, in 2 days, we can procure from our storehouses any quantity we may please. Based upon that, Article 3, sentences 1 through 4. Surely there is no need to seek further proof that our rule is predestined by God. Well, yes, there is, but they may think that nonetheless. Surely we shall not fail with such wealth to prove that all that the evil which for so many centuries we have had to commit has served at the end of ends the cause of true well-being, the bringing everything into order. Again, that sounds like situational ethics to me. Oh, we've got to do bad in order to bring about good, or at least the good that they want, the thing that which they want to call good. Remember, the world is always calling that which is good bad and that which is evil good. So keep that in mind. Also, it says in bringing everything into order. I wonder if they may not be talking about the new world order that others are talking about today as well. Continuing, it says, though it even be by the exercise of some violence, yet all the same it will be established. We will contrive to prove that we are benefactors who have restored to the rent and mangled earth the true good and also freedom of the person, and therewith we shall enable it to be enjoyed in peace and quiet with a proper dignity of relations on the condition, of course, and here's what I want to emphasize, based on the fact that they say they've got the power of the gold, the power of the riches, they say, they declare, let me back up and start here at a different point, on the condition, of course, of strict observance of the laws established by us. End of quote. Through, of course, the power and the influence of money. Meyer Nathaniel Rothschild, you've heard this quote before because I've shared it with you in other messages, basically said the same thing. He said, quote, "Let me control a people's currencies, and I care not who makes their laws." End of quote. Because he knew if he controlled the currency of a nation, then whoever it was who would make the laws would simply be doing his work under his control and power and influence of money. President James A. Garfield said the following. He said, quote, "Whosoever controls the volume of money in any country is absolute master of all industry and commerce." End of that quote. Sounds like the rich rule. Sounds like people understand. The rich as a general rule. By the way, the dominion of the rich, who therefore have the power to legislate, is over Christendom today, speaking of today, is over Christendom as well. And anyone who doesn't think that Christendom is presently not subservient to the non-Christians, just, for example, try building a church building without a building permit. Or try discriminating on who you hire as church employees today. Or try retaining your 501c3 tax-exempt status, which of course also proves who's ruling who and is a message for in itself, but try retaining your 501c3 status, if you have one, God forbid, while trying to sway the public or even your own parishioners on political matters, let's say like elections. If you don't think that the non-Christians who have the power don't rule over Christianity as well. You know, even every election, or nearly every election in publications like Focus on the Family, Dr. Dobson admits he can't instruct on anything political because he's got this burden of those who rule over him. Others do the same thing. So it's right there. It's a fact of life. The rich rule over the poor. And I don't know about you, but I think it's high time that Christians wake up and take this area back from the non-Christians and the Antichrist, which is at least, again, one of the principal reasons for this whole series. That is that we might teach our children and our grandchildren these biblical principles, that we, Christianity, might once again rule in this nation as we once did when we had the power, when we had the rule, and therefore, or because we once had the riches. It was Christianity who ruled in this country by God's power and by His grace. I'm not trying to remove us from that realm in any sense. But because they were the ones who were wealthy, they once ruled and they once had legislative power, and therefore they directed the morality of this country. And then that, and returning to that, and that with that power and that influence, we might implement and enforce Yahweh's laws in society as a whole. That's the primary, the principal point of this whole series. I mean, we need to deal with the individual intricacies and each of the principles and learn those, but it's for the end, a long-range goal. Obviously, it's not going to happen overnight, but we've got to start having a long-range vision for our children and our grandchildren once again, that we can and we will take this arena and the other arenas back from the Antichrist and the non-Christians. Oh, by the way, guess what verse proceeds Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7. Someone will be likely thinking, at least in the tape ministry, they'll be thinking, oh, you dummy, verse 6. Well, yes, verse 6 precedes it, but what does verse 6 say? Nearly everybody knows it. Think about it. What's Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6 say? You know, too often we get hung up on individual verses. And not that that's bad. You know, we want to glean from an individual verse everything that we can, but sometimes we don't glean as much as we can from an individual verse if we don't tie it to the verse following or possibly the verse prior, if we don't tie it into its context. What comes just prior to Proverbs chapter 22:7? Nearly all of us know it. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 6, train up a child in the way he should go, and he will not depart from it when he grows old. Now, that comes just prior to verse 7 that says the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is slave to the master. I suspect God put those two verses together for a reason. I think he had a reason for putting verse 6 just before verse 7. It's because he, as a part of what we were to teach and train our children in, was the proper biblical perspective of riches for his kingdom's sake. Let's not think that God just wants us rich. He wants us rich in order to rule, to take dominion on his behalf, so that we can create a society of his laws and therefore his morality throughout. Heaven on earth is what he wants. And obviously he wants us to train up our children that we need to have a biblical perspective on economics, that Christians might rule, not non-Christians and antichrist. The rich, let's get it in our heads, the rich rule over the poor. Now back on point, not only does the rich rule over the poor, but it tells us in Proverbs 22:7 that the borrower is servant or slave to the lender. Guess what they understood in the protocols? Protocol chapter 20, article 20 and sentence 3. It says loans burden the finances of the state with the payment of interest and made them the bond slave of these capitals. End of quote. The borrower is slave to the master. He's a bond slave. Bond. You know, we go bond. It's a good guy. I hadn't thought about that, but it's a good two terms. We're bond slaves. The fact is, the first and second halves of this verse are essentially really saying the same thing. Who's always the lender? Well, of course, the rich. The poor is never the lender. The rich is always the lender, and the poor are always the borrowers, and therefore the slaves. Now, who do you suppose Yahweh wants His people to be? Who do you suppose that Yahweh wants His people to be? The borrowers or the lenders? Slaves or freemen? Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Most of you immediately should know what that chapter deals with, the blessings and the curses of Yahweh, depending on whether we follow Him and His laws and His principles of morality. Deuteronomy 28, beginning with verse 1. In verse 1 it says, "And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of Yahweh thy God, to observe and to do all of His commandments, which I command thee this day, that Yahweh thy God will set thee on high above all the nations of the earth." So he's talking about all of his laws. If we're in obedience to Him, if we follow His voice, that He's going to set us on high above all the rich, of all the nations of the earth. Now, whoever He sets on high, that's simply an idiom that means, "I'm going to make you the rulers." And who is it that rules? The rich. So if God's going to make us the rulers, He also intends to make us rich. The two go hand in hand. And then verse 2, "And all of these blessings shall come upon thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of Yahweh thy God." Now it's obvious from those two verses alone, and myriads of others throughout His Word, it's obvious that Yahweh wants to bless His people. We serve a God who wants to bless us. It's not automatic. I mean, that's very clear. He doesn't just bless us just because we're here, but He wants to bless His people, doesn't He? And one of the blessings is that His people would be the lenders and not the borrowers, and therefore the rulers and not the slaves. Look at verses 12 and 13 of this same chapter. Verse 12, it says, "And Yahweh shall open unto thee His good treasure, the heaven, to give the rain unto thy land in the season." Sounds a lot like what we read previously as concerns tithing and giving God what is His just due from our increase. That's recorded in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 10. God says, "I'll open up the storehouses of heaven if you'll just trust Me and do it My way. Follow My biblical economic principles. I'll bless you beyond what you can imagine." And He says again here in this verse, He says, "Yahweh shall open unto thee His good treasure, the heaven, and to give the rain unto the land in His season, and to bless all the work of thy hand, and thou shalt lend unto many nations, and thou shalt not borrow." Let me see if I want to go further. Yes, verse 13. "And Yahweh shall make thee the head and not the tail." That's the head that rules. I'll guarantee you, it's the stinking end never rules. It's always got the stinking end of things. He says, "I don't want you to be the stinking end, the tail end. I want you to be the head." He says, "I'll make you the head. And Yahweh shall make thee the head and not the tail, and thou shalt be above many, and thou shalt not be beneath, if thou shalt hearken unto the commandments of Yahweh thy God, which I command thee this day to observe and to do them." God says, one of the blessings is, "I'm going to make you the lenders and not the borrowers." And therefore, God wants us to be not the slaves, but He wants us to be the rulers. On the other hand, when cursed, and don't miss that, when cursed, Yahweh makes us the borrowers. Look at verses 43 and 44, which is essentially just the opposite of what we just read. In verse 43, it says, "The stranger that is within thee shall get up above thee very high." Kind of sounds like what's happening in America today, doesn't it? "And thou shalt come down very low. He shall lend to thee, and thou shalt not lend to him. He shall be the head, and thou shalt be the stinking end, the tail." That's where we're at today. We're being cursed because we're not following His principles. Once the previous verses were a description of early America. These latter scriptures, how regrettably, now describe America today. And what's really regrettable is most people don't even realize it. They still think we're blessed. They have not a clue. They've been so brainwashed. But one of the curses, don't miss this, that's just one of them, but one of the curses is that God says, I'll make you the lenders. You know what? The Bible says we're a peculiar people. Now, that's King James Version. It really means a special people. But as we normally would think of peculiar today, that's a pretty good description of us. What a peculiar, what an odd, what a strange people we Israelites are. And that's putting it lightly. That's being kind. Not only do we willingly choose slavery, but we voluntarily choose to be cursed. I mean, it's just not that God curses us. We choose it. We choose to be cursed because it's a curse. It tells us that. It's right there. It's a curse to be in debt. And yet the majority of our people, with no impending emergency, run down to their local banker, or their credit card broker, and stick out their hands and plead with them to shackle them. Shackle me in debt. You know, nothing new under the sun, is there? Right? Isn't that what Solomon tells us? Is there anything new about that? You know, us doing that? It may not have happened in the same way, but let me guarantee you, there is nothing new under the sun. It's absolutely no different than the Israelites of old, after having been given their freedom from Egyptian slavery, which principally was an economic slavery, by the way. Nothing new under the sun in that fashion either. But it's essentially the same thing that the Israelites of old did when the first time they ran into a little hardship after being granted their freedom. They're now out in the wilderness, headed for the promised land. They run into a little bit of hardship. And the first thing they do is they go to grumbling and complaining and, what else? Demanding. Didn't they? Demanding to go back into Egyptian serfdom. Where's our garlic? Where's our onions? We liked it back there. We had garlic and onions. Shackle me some more. Put me back. I want to go back to the mud pits. There's nothing new under the sun. That's exactly what's happening today with Israelites today as well. Get this into your heads. If you don't walk away from this message with anything else, get this down. Write it on your hearts. Write it on your minds and write it in stone if you must. Debt is slavery and a curse. Period. Think of it in this fashion. On time is just another way of saying doing time. Because that's what you're doing. You're just doing time. You know, most of our people today, again, with no concept, and I'm talking Christians as well, with no concept of what God says in this regard. Or they may read it, but it doesn't ever sink in. It's obvious because they go out and do just the opposite. But society today, they think that credit is such a wonderful thing. Everybody does. Nearly everybody. No credit. Oh, that's a wonderful thing. Yeah, it's wonderful, all right. Credit enables anybody to start at the bottom and then to go in a hole. Oh, credit, that's a great thing. You know, stick me in a hole. What a topsy-turvy world we live in today. A couple weeks ago, I'm involved because I fly a lot in United's Mileage Plus, where you accumulate so many miles and they'll give you some benefits like a free ticket or other things, and they've tied in with other companies like hotels and restaurants and all kinds of different things, and that you can, for example, this last weekend we were in Omaha and I stayed at a hotel and I was able to get extra miles by staying at a particular hotel that was in cahoots, if you will, with United's program. And they had recently sent out a notice, United did, that if you'll sign up with Nextel phone company and get your cell phone through Nextel, that you can get miles. You get so many miles for signing up. I think it was like 1,000 miles for signing up. and you get so many miles for every $5 or $10 or something that you use in your Nextel phone. So I thought, well, we need another phone. Why not go Nextel? So I call up the appropriate people and tell them that I'd like to get into the program, but I tell them I don't use a credit card, so we'll need to do this in some other fashion. Would you explain how I can pay cash? And she says, oh, well, you know, just almost had a heart attack that didn't have a credit card. I said, I pay everything by cash right away. Oh, we can't do that. And she started looking, flipping through the things. Oh, okay, well, if you'll fill out a credit report. And I said, lady, I just told you I don't borrow anything. There is no credit report on me. And the response was, well, then we can't do it. You've got to have a credit card. You know, here am I, somebody who's willing to pay up front, and I can't get it. I can't get credit for anything. Can't sign up for Nextel. Well, no big loss. I won't worry about it. Rather be out of debt than have Nextel, I'll guarantee you. However, having said all of that, I nevertheless do believe in credit. That is the type of credit described in a store window once, which described credit, their credit plan, in the following fashion. It said, use our easy credit plan, 100% down, and nothing to pay every month. I like that kind of credit. You know, nothing, think about it, nothing to pay every month. Pay for it up front, and you never have to worry about that payment. You're never under the curse of having to make sure that I meet that payment every single month until the thing's paid off. And not just getting it paid off for the price that it was that they're asking for it, but then you have the interest on top of it that keeps you paying and paying and paying and paying sometimes. Use God's credit plan. 100% down, nothing to pay every month. Now, I know there are Christian ministries that do promote, that are debt, let me put it this way, that are death on debt. Except when it comes to debt on something that retains or appreciates in value. I mean, there are lots of ministries in that fashion. As long as it at least will retain its value, it's not on something that depreciates, or something even better. Boy, if you know that it has the chance of appreciating in value, go in the debt. It's an investment. In fact, the following items, as an example, I took right out of a Christian publication. They suggested on land, livestock, precious metals, and houses, of course. That's something you can pretty well bank on in most situations, that retains or increases in value. And therefore, Christians are promoting, some Christian organizations are therefore promoting debt on such quote-unquote investments. However, let me repeat myself. Do not, whatever you do, go into debt, not even for a quote-unquote great investment. Listen to me closely. It's not a great investment, especially you young people. It is not. Trust me. It is not a great investment, no matter how good the returns may be, if you have to sell yourself into slavery for who knows how many years in order to hopefully secure your gain. That's not a good investment. John Weaver put it this way. He said, if you're in debt, your time is not your own. You're working for someone else. You're not working for yourself. You're working for somebody else. Now think about that. Even your time is not your own. How important is time? Time is more important than money. We decided in a previous message or two, didn't we? Would you rather run out of time or rather run out of money? Your time isn't even your own. Takes us right back to principle number 5, and that's efficient and effective time management. Let me tell you, going to debt is not efficient and effective time management. You can't even get close to it. Therefore, don't sell yourselves into slavery for the potential of a good investment. There is no good investment if you have to sell yourself into slavery. Once again, you're simply doing time in slavery. Listen to me. Your freedom is worth more than whatever returns or gains you might receive by going into debt. Take it for someone who knows who has now lived on both sides of those bars of slavery. Which brings us back to the second half of the former question, and that is, does Yahweh want us to be slaves or does He want us to be freemen? Take your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and I'm going to read verse 23. Verse 23, it says, "You were bought with a price." Now listen to the next part of it. We all understand that. We were bought with a price. Praise God that we were. Therefore, understand this too. This is more particularly, not that this wouldn't be good advice for non-Christians as well, but don't miss the fact that this is speaking to Christians particularly. Christians of all people need to heed the following instructions. Again, verse 23 says, "Ye were bought with a price." That means you, and that means me. You were bought with a price, and therefore we are to follow the following instruction. It says, "Therefore be not ye the servants of men." New American Standard again takes the servants and makes it even stronger and says, "Be ye not slaves of men." Now, that can't be stated any clearer. Debt is slavery to men, right? The borrower is slave to the lender. So debt is slavery to men. And we're commanded not to become slaves to men. And therefore, catch this, we are commanded not to go in to debt. That makes us slaves to men. That really couldn't be any clearer. If it's the case it's not, look at Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13 and verse 8. It says, again, can't get any clearer than this. It says, "Owe no man anything except or but to love one another, for he that loveth another has fulfilled the law." We do owe it to each other to love each other. And we need to learn that lesson too. We don't love each other as a whole throughout Christendom like we should. We need to learn to love. We owe that. We need to understand that it's more than we need to do more than just learn that lesson. We need to understand what it says here. We owe that to each other. But then we never need to figure out the former part to that as well. And that is that God says, except for that, it should be our goal that we owe no man anything except to love Him. Turn to Proverbs chapter 22. Back to chapter 22, I said. That's kind of where we began. Proverbs chapter 22, a little bit later in the chapter, verse 26, to begin with. It says, "Be not thou one of them that strike hands, or of them that are sureties for debts." Now, most people know what sureties for debt is. It's putting up a surety, or what's another word for surety? Collateral, thank you. Putting up collateral. Something that you have as collateral for a debt, yours or someone else's. But what's this striking hands? It says, again, verse 26, be not thou one of them that strike hands. Well, from what I understand, that was just simply another way that maybe they slapped hands like they do today instead of shaking hands. But it was a contractual agreement based upon the honor of one man to another and his word being as good as gold, where they'd shake hands. In this case, striking hands or shaking hands in Proverbs 22:6 refers to making a contract with someone by which you go surety, either for yourself or for someone else. So, with that in mind, now let's read verse 26 with the following verse. "Be not thou one of them that striketh hands, or of them that are sureties for debts. If thou hast nothing to pay, why should he take away thy bed from under thee?" He says, that's why you don't want to do it. In other words, don't put yourself into a position of possibly losing what you have in order to, in an attempt, not just in order to, because sometimes it's only an attempt to, in an attempt to obtain what you don't need. And I might add that probably 95% of the things that modern man thinks he needs or thinks that he can't live without, he can.
That's just the way it is.
95% of the things that man thinks he can't, modern man thinks he can't, because, by the way, I can prove that by the fact that men who we wouldn't call modern, you know, 100 years ago or whatever, they lived without 95% of the things that we think we can't live without. So there it is. 95% plus, probably, of the things we think we can't live without, we can. The problem with most people is that their yearning capacity exceeds their earning capacity. Ecclesiastes 6:9, in fact, even basically provides that very point. Ecclesiastes chapter, whoops, that's 6:9, says the following. Basically the same thing. Yearning capacity exceeds earning capacity. Here it is. Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes, in other words, what you have, what you can hold on to, what you can see and hold on to, better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. Oh, there's all those things that the world loves to paint for us that we need, all these commercials that make things look so appetizing and so good that we think we just can't live without. The Bible says, Solomon in his wisdom says, better is what the eyes can see than what the lust of your heart desires. In fact, the Living Bible translates it this way, fashion. You've heard this before, and simply took this saying, and this is how they interpreted it or paraphrased it. They said, a bird in the hand is worth more than two in the bush. That's exactly how the Living Bible, doesn't translate it, but renders that particular verse. One in the hand that you're willing to jeopardize is worth a whole lot more than two in the bush that you don't have yet and you think you can't live without. Furthermore, most people buy on time with little or buy on time or due time, buy on time with little or no consideration that they may not be able to meet the financial obligations of their loans. Most people go in, and, you know, everything's rosy in the future. I'm going to be doing a whole lot better in the future than I am now. I can guarantee you, you know, I've got a great job. Well, how many people in the last year have lost their jobs? And most people go into those situations, those contractual agreements, with little or no consideration that they may not be able to meet their obligations of the loan. It obviously happens. In fact, it happens, I'll guarantee you, much more than most people have ever realized. In 2001, just last year, there were 43,000 foreclosures on people's beds or their homes. 43,000 foreclosures in the state of Ohio alone. Now, I don't know whether it's a good average. It may be low, it may be a little bit high, but I suspect it's probably a good, fair representation of a national average. And if it is a national average or even close to it, then nationally that would mean that 2,150,000 people who thought they were making a great investment lost their beds, lost their homes, and the equity. Don't miss that too. They don't lose just their homes. They lose all the equity they put into their homes. All the money that they could have had they not put it into that quote-unquote great investment and then lost it in the process in 2001. You know, I have a sneaking suspicion that it's going to be worse in 2002. That there's going to be more than 2,150,000 people who will find themselves in the very same situation. It would be a good idea to keep in mind that a banker has been described from time to time as a man who loans you an umbrella when the weather is fair and takes it away when it begins to rain. Pretty good description. You know, it seems like people kind of understand these things. There were two farmers talking at the mill, and one says to the other, he says, hey, Dusty, how's your banker trusting you? And he says, oh, he's helping me get back on my feet. Just the other day, he repossessed my truck. You know, people understand. If you can find that in a joke book, you know that people understand it. Here's another one, real close to the same thing. Blondie cartoon that somebody sent me years ago. Dagwood is sitting next to somebody in a bus or on a subway, and the fellow next to him says, he says, when I applied for a loan, the guy told me, you'll always have a friend down here at the bank. And Dagwood looks at the guy and says, well, what's wrong with that? And the fellow responds, he says, well, today my friend is driving my car. You know, how interesting that our people understand that. It's, you know what it is? It's God's law written on their hearts. They understand and they know that's the case. And yet, what do? We are a odd people. We know that. And we turn around, run right down to the banker and say, here, shackle me. Take away my car. I'm going to give you the potential of at least taking away my home, my bed, my car, my truck, and everything else that I might have, that I might put up for collateral. What an odd people. Note that in Proverbs 22 and verse 26, not only commands us against going into debt for yourself, but it specifically also says, don't do it for your brother or your friend either. Yeah, but somebody might say, yeah, but what about if my brother? You know, you can see the compassion in people. We are a compassionate people. You say, yeah, but what about if when my brother's in dire need and that's my only way to help him? Well, turn to Proverbs chapter 17. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 17. It says, a friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. So, there you have it. You know, there's an exception there, right? A brother is born for adversity. Or how does it put it again? A friend loveth at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. You know, you got to help your brother out. Except when it comes to going surety for that brother. You know, Yahweh obviously knew. He obviously knew that we would likely bail a brother or a friend out of debt by even going into debt ourselves. In other words, to put ourselves in the very same predicament or fix that our brother foolishly got himself into. That our compassion would overrule our better senses and do so. And therefore, with verse 17's instructions in mind that a friend loveth at all times and a brother is born for adversity, with that in mind, God then inspired Solomon with the following in the very next verse. In verse 18 it says, and a man void of understanding striketh hands, maketh that agreement with the banker, with the lender again, and becometh surety in the presence or for his friend. So God says, yeah, you are to help your brother out. You're to do everything you can for your friend, your neighbor, whatever you can, except don't go into debt for him, whatever you do. If he gets himself in that fix, you don't get yourself in that fix as well. The Jerusalem Bible translates verse 18 in the following fashion. He says, he lacks sense who offers guarantees and goes surety for his neighbor. Let me put it to you in plain old cowboy terms. You're not too bright. You're just not too bright if you go into debt either for yourself or for your brother or friend if you don't have to. Somebody put it this way. We've now reached the seven dwarfs stage of taking out a mortgage. When you go to the bank, you're bashful. When you hear mortgages are still available, oh, you're happy. And when you're told the rate, you're grumpy. And if you accept them, yeah, you're dopey. Working our way backwards in Proverbs, look at Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 15. Try to get you the full of much impact on this debt situation as I can for the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 15 says, he that is surety for a stranger, I like this, it says, shall smart for it. He who is surety for a stranger shall smart for it, and he that hateth suretyship is sure. The amplified in this for this verse is somewhat similar except for the last part. It says, he who becomes security for an outsider shall smart for it, but he who hates suretyship is secure from its penalties. Let me tell you, there is a penalty. There's always a penalty. I mean, you may not in the long run lose your home. You may be able to get your way through the debt, but there's always a penalty, especially under a usury system. There's a tremendous penalty to pay. and your money is very poorly invested if you are paying usury or interest on anything that you have to borrow. Go back to Proverbs chapter 6 now, verses 1 through 5. It says, "My son, if thou be surety for thy friend, if thou hast stricken thy hand with a stranger," so it's covering both of them now, stranger or friend, "thou art snared with the words of thy mouth, thou art taken with the words of thy mouth. Do this now then, my son, and deliver thyself." See the urgency there? "Do this then, my son, and deliver thyself when thou art come into the hand of thy friend. Go humble thyself and make sure thy friend." Verse 4, "Give not sleep to thine eyes, nor slumber to thine eyelids. Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler." Listen to me, in addition, and I hope you don't miss this, in addition to being cursed and enslaved, as if that wasn't bad enough, but in addition to being cursed and enslaved, Yahweh compares being in debt to being hunted like a wild animal. Isn't that what it says? Again, it says, verse 5, "Deliver thyself from the roe of thy, from the hand of the hunter, and as the bird from the hand of the fowler." It's like being hunted like a wild animal. Now, based on all the previous passages that we've looked at, it shouldn't be any clearer, but let me state it to you once again. Based on the previous passages, if you're in debt, do everything in your power. Excuse me, if you're not in debt, do everything in your power to stay out of debt. Do whatever you have to stay out of debt. And if you're in debt, as many people who either are or will be hearing this message in the future, do everything in your power. Everything in your power as quick as you can to get out of debt, get yourself out of debt. And again, that's the point. He says, give not slumber to your eyelids or sleep to your eyes. In other words, do it. Do everything in your power to do it, and do it as quickly as you can. Now, that may mean that it may take a while. But do it as quick as you can, nevertheless. Because until you're out of debt, you are simply a slave. And you will never rule as God intends you to rule, even your own little kingdom within His kingdom. Look at what Yahweh immediately contrasts, going surety or going into debt too in this particular passage. Verse 6 begins, it says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer and gathereth her food in the harvest. How long wilt thou sleep, O sluggard? When wilt thou arise out of thy sleep? Yet a little sleep and a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall thy poverty come as one that travaileth, and thy want as an armed man." In other words, what's that telling us? Well, if you want something, put those two verses, first five verses and the next four verses together. If you want something and you can't afford it, the answer is found in biblical economic principle number 3. W-O-R-K. Work until you can afford it, or simply go without it. But whatever you do, do not go into debt and thereby jeopardize what you already have, including your children's future. In 2 Kings 4 and verse 1, we find the following. It says, "Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, Thy servant, my husband, is dead, and thou knowest that thy servant did fear Yahweh, and the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be his bondmen." It's foolish enough for us to go into debt, not considering our own future. But what's even more foolish and more tragic is when we go into debt and don't consider our children's. There's been many a man who has put himself in debt thinking he could get out and dies in the process and puts his own progeny there into slavery themselves to cover his debt. God forbid that we would sell our progeny into slavery
Instead, let us teach them the following principles of biblical economics. Number one, seek first His kingdom and His righteousness. Number two, seek wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. Number three, work. Number four, tithing, free will offerings, and charitable contributions. Number five, efficient and effective time management. Number six, Sabbath. Number seven, save, save, and save. And number eight, stay out of debt. And there's more to come. We also need to teach our progeny as we take on a long-range vision for ourselves, for our children, our grandchildren, for this nation as a whole. Let's not put them in slavery. Let's get out of slavery. Who wants to be in slavery? I don't know about you. I want to be a freeman. And I want to be a ruler. Not for my sake, but for the sake of our God and the sake of our children. Let's stand and we'll close this in prayer. Heavenly Father, we're very thankful, Lord, again, for your instructions and your word, especially in this area, Lord, that is so critical for our nation today. I pray that you bless this message, that you take it beyond what I could even imagine. Reach our people, Father, with the fact that they need to be out of debt, that they need to get out of debt, that that's your desire for them, and that it's a curse, Father, from you when they are in debt for having disobeyed your principles and your laws. Help us to see that the blessing is being the lender and not the borrower. Help us to see that credit is a curse and not a blessing. Help us to be the ones that take dominion for your sake. Bless our people, open their hearts and their minds to see and understand. And help us to return this nation to sanity and, Father, therefore, to your laws and your morality as found in your word. We ask these things and we praise you, Father, for them in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.